Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side B of For the Record program number 256. This is about Campaign 2000, and we're going to begin right where we left off at the end of Side A. And this half hour is going to focus largely on the Middle East, and in particular, oil. Well, as we've looked at in so many broadcasts, including RFA program number 31, there is massive evidence of collusion between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini forces in Iran, and in the remarkable exposés of Fatah Mansour, a member of the Iranian resistance, we've taken a look at indications that there was not only collusion between the holders of the hostages, but there was actual collusion between the Reagan-Bush camp and the fundamentalists with regard to the taking of the hostages as well. Once again, we have a George Bush running on the Republican ticket. Once again, the Middle East is heating up. Once again, oil prices are rising. Once again, quote, Islamic fundamentalists, unquote, note the quotes, are among the factors that are destabilizing the region. And I think, once again, we need to ask questions about what connections may exist between some elements of the intelligence community, the petroleum industry, and some of the violent Muslim extremists that we're hearing about. We're also going to be asking questions about the possible influence on these events of connections between the American far right and the Israeli far right. In that regard, we're going to turn directly to an article from the Searchlight magazine, the British anti-fascist publication. This comes from the Searchlight's issue of October of the year 2000. That's issue number 304. This is an article that we looked at in program number 252. It's entitled International Fascist Axis. It's by Jerry Gable, and it reads in part as follows, skipping down. At a private breakfast meeting last spring between Berlusconi, Fini, and the former U.S. Ambassador Maxwell Rabb, an old friend of the Italian far right, a fourth person present was Pier Fernando Cassini. Cassini, a member of the Christian Center Democrats, is known in Italy as the Ayatollah of the Catholic fundamentalist movement. But as well as courting Catholics, the Pole of Liberty is also trying to win friends among far-right-wing Jews in Israel and New York. The Jewish community in Rome and the new and growing community in Trieste, recently enlarged by Jews leaving Carinthia, the Austrian province under Haider's political control, now fear they may be endangered and isolated by those Israelis who share many of Berlusconi's and Fini's political views. Rab is the key player in these dirty political dealings. By the way, Silvio Berlusconi is favored by many to win the upcoming Italian elections. He had previously been the head of state and headed a coalition government with Gianfranco Fini, the head of the National Alliance, or Alleanza Nazionale, the Italian fascist party that is the direct successor to Mussolini's fascist party. We took a look at links between the American far right, the fascist coalition government of Silvio Berlusconi, himself a member of the P2 Lodge under Licio Gelli, and we looked at connections between the American far right, the Italian far right, and also the Israeli far right as well. And we've looked at some of those links in numerous programs, including For the Record segment number 113, the miscellaneous archive show entitled Fascist Zionist Connections, a miscellaneous archive show entitled Strange Bedfellows, and For the Record program number 94, I believe it was, to look at global fascism. One of the things to consider as one examines some of this networking is to what extent some of the recent events in the Middle East may have been deliberately provoked, I guess one could say. Bear in mind that there are links within the international fascist community between the American far right, including elements of the Republican Party, and the most extreme elements on both sides of the Israeli-Palestinian question, with overt fascist elements having spawned much of the Israeli far right, and in turn, overtly fascist elements, including elements of the Third Reich and the post-war Odessa SS network, have documented links to the most extreme elements of the Palestinian national movement, including Yasser Arafat. So bear that in mind, and bear in mind that one of the things that has apparently destroyed the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, and it is also boosting the price of oil and destabilizing world equities markets, is the fact that the whole Middle East situation has been heated up, and this follows an extreme Palestinian reaction to Ariel Sharon of the Likud parties visiting a shrine in Israel that is held holy by both Muslims and Jews. And one wonders to what extent not only perhaps, I say perhaps, the behavior of Ariel Sharon and or other elements of the extreme far right in Israel, and in turn elements of the most reactionary elements in the Palestinian community may have been deliberately provoked. I would note that the very day that George Bush nominated Dick Cheney to be his vice presidential candidate was the very day that Yasser Arafat broke off talks with Ehud Barak of Israel. Continuing. Earlier this year, a report circulated that a youth camp for followers of Berlusconi's and Fini's youth wings, as well as from the Northern League, was attended by an official group from the youth movement of Israel's right-wing Likud party. It took place at the very time that an Italian MP was complaining that the Northern League's official website carried vicious anti-Jewish material and pro-Nazi slogans. The Likud group was led by Eli Cohen, a political counselor to former Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu. Cohen declared that his party preferred Feeney to the left, who support the Palestinians. Bear in mind, again, the links between the American far right, including the right wing of the Republican Party, and the most extreme elements on both sides of the Israeli-Palestinian question, and one wonders about some of the recent networking going on between the Likud party, of which Ariel Sharon is a member, and perhaps the Republican far right, and in turn between the most extreme elements of the Palestinian movement, and perhaps elements of the petroleum industry, both in the Middle East and situated among the Arabs in the countries that have the petroleum reserves, and also among the Western petroleum executives of companies that stand to benefit from an increase in the price of oil. This is all to be seen against the background of For the Record program number 214, entitled Trouble on Oiled Waters Part 2, and in turn against many of the connections that we've dealt with in the context of the Bush family and some of their petroleum connections and some of the intelligence connections in the Middle East. In particular, bear in mind George Bush the Elder's role in developing the interagency governmental networks that grew out of the Vice President's Task Force on Combating Terrorism. That vice president at the time having been George Bush, and bear in mind that the networks that were thus created and placed under George Bush's control were used to affect the machinations in both the Iran-Contra and Iraqgate affairs, because we're going to take a look at links between the right wing of the Republican Party, including those elements currently heading up the ticket, the petroleum industry, and some of the Islamic extremists or Arab extremists, quote-unquote, in the Middle East, including Iraq and Iran. One of the things to note is that the undermining of the peace process in the Middle East has, among other things, put Hillary Clinton under an increased degree of political heat as she challenges Rick Lazio for the Senate seat that was held by Daniel Moynihan. Bear in mind that struggle for control of the Senate is at this point very much up in the air. Obviously, Jewish voters are a major voting constituency in the state of New York, and Hillary's relatively moderate stance with regard to the claims of the Palestinians has provoked some elements among more conservative has provoked some of the more conservative elements in the Jewish community, thus placing Hillary Clinton under increasing pressure for her senatorial race against Rick Lazio. We're going to take a look now at the Financial Times of London of Tuesday, October 17th of the year 2000. This is a column by Amedee Schlaes, S-H-L-A-E-S, headline, "The Middle East tells us the hawks were right." And skipping down, we read, this is about Rabbi Hirsch, an Orthodox rabbi, who has been very critical of Hillary Clinton. It's specifically Rabbi Amiel Hirsch, head of the Association of Reform Zionists of America. This particular article is excerpted as follows. By the way, not a conservative rabbi, obviously, but a pro-Zionist rabbi, this, however, of the reform element of the Jewish faith in the United States. Skipping down, of the increased pressure that events in the Middle East have placed on Hillary Clinton and, as a consequence, Democratic hopes to capture the Senate in a fall, Rabbi Hirsch is right about the doubts. When Hillary Clinton attended a rally in New York on Friday to protest about the lynching of Israeli soldiers at Ramallah, a crowd of 15,000 booed her because she had once publicly kissed Mr. Arafat's wife. Unlike previous pro-Israel demonstrations, which advocated land for peace deals, this one simply expressed solidarity with the Jewish homeland. "Israel, we are with you," read the waving signs. So again, note that the geopolitics in the Middle East has made the political fortunes of Hillary Clinton that much more precarious, and as a consequence, the political fortunes of the Democratic Party with regard to its hopes to capture the Senate. Again, one of the questions I'm asking is to what extent events in the Middle East, disturbingly reminiscent of what we saw in 1980, where we had an unstable Middle East, rising petroleum prices, and terrorism in the Middle East launched by Islamic extremists, quote-unquote, and it turned out that those Islamic extremists, unquote, and some of those terrorist-supporting nations, unquote, were in bed with the very elements that were waving the flag of alarm against those same elements, namely the Reagan-Bush administration and the elements of the intelligence community and the petroleum industry that were associated with them. And again, the question I'm asking is to what extent not only Al Gore but the Democrats are being destabilized once again in the year 2000. Consider the following. This from the New York Times of Friday, September 22nd of the year 2000, with regard to rising oil prices and the effect on the economy. And bear in mind, virtually everything uses oil, either directly or indirectly. If it doesn't use it in the production process, it uses it to heat the buildings where the production takes place, and it uses it to transport goods from the market and also raw materials to the place of manufacture. In short, you raise the price of oil, you screw the economy. Again, from the New York Times of Friday, September 22nd of the year 2000, this is a column by Floyd Norris. Its headline, Can Al Gore Survive Rising Oil Prices and Falling Stocks? The latter in part, at least because of the former, and the political instability in the Middle East. And again, the question I'm asking, to what extent was this all predetermined? This column reads in part as follows. As election forecasters go, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has a better record than most, and its latest swan dive may be bad news for Al Gore. This will be the 26th presidential election since Charles H. Dow put his industrial average together in 1897. So far, its record as an election prognosticator is 22-3, not perfect, but at least as good as the average pollster. The indicator says that if the Dow rises from the end of July through the end of October, the 3 months when investors are most attuned to the political season, the incumbent party will win the election. If the Dow falls, however, the incumbents will be thrown out. Perhaps a rising stock market reflects contented voters. And skipping down again, in recent elections, the record has been perfect. The Dow fell in 1976, 1980, and 1992, all years that the incumbent president lost. The incumbent party prevailed in 1972, 84, 88, and 96 when the Dow rose. The Dow indicator is broadly consistent with a number of other historical trends. It is highly unusual for an incumbent party to be thrown out unless there is substantial discontent about the economy. This year, most pundits treated Mr. Gore as a long shot throughout much of the summer, notwithstanding the strong economy. They reversed course as he pulled ahead in the polls after the Democratic convention in August. As it happened, the Dow started an impressive rise before the convention, gaining 7.6% or almost 800 points from July 27th through September 6th. With August up nicely, it looked as if the Dow was backing Mr. Gore. But since then, the Dow has slid, dropping in 9 of 11 sessions, including 6 in a row before it rebounded yesterday. Not since 1995 had the Dow gone down in 6 consecutive sessions. Since September 6th, the Dow is down 4.8%, wiping out most of the August gains. What went wrong? To be crude about it, oil. The comfortable Wall Street assumption that the Federal Reserve has engineered a soft landing in which growth would slow enough to stem inflation, but not enough to do real damage, is being challenged by the continued rise in oil prices. Recessions followed previous oil shocks. The Republicans, to be sure, could have picked better candidates to fight over oil. Both George W. Bush and Dick Cheney are former oil company executives who once praised rising oil prices. Mr. Gore will bash the sky-high profit margins the oil refiners now enjoy. For his part, Mr. Bush will denounce the Clinton administration as not having an effective energy policy, and that could have an effect. Like it or not, the Dow and the election may turn on whether oil prices stay high for the next 6 weeks. I would point out that the Republicans have indeed been criticizing the Clinton administration's petroleum prices, as they have been criticizing the Clinton administration in connection with some aspects of the handling of the terrorist attack on the destroyer Cole. We're going to talk about some of the criticisms that Republicans have had of the Clinton administration in that context later. With regard to Dick Cheney, his connections to the oil industry, specifically his role as the head of Halliburton Oil, consider the following. This from the Wall Street Journal of Tuesday, October 17th of the year 2000. Bear in mind that Dick Cheney was George Bush's Secretary of Defense during the Gulf War. This is an article by Jackie Calmes, or Calmes, C-A-L-M-E-S. Its headline, Cheney's Work in Gulf War Could Help GOP in Light of Current Mideast Crisis. I'm not going to read the article. What it basically maintains is that the connections that were formed by Dick Cheney during his tenure as Secretary of Defense during the Persian Gulf War might very well help the GOP in that their expertise in the Middle East, in light of all the instability there, might move voters to back the GOP. Now, bear in mind that George Bush, as head of the interagency governmental networks that and the agency that with the private intelligence agency that he acquired as a result of those, the creation of those networks, bear in mind that George Bush was front and center, literally the most important person. With regard to the arms transfers to both Iraq and Iran in the 1980s, this at a time when both were pariah nations and were being excoriated for their role in promoting international terrorism and instability in the Middle East. Consider the potential impact of both nations, both Iran and Iraq, on the current political situation in the United States because of their impact as major oil producers and because of the impact of petroleum on the economy. And again, we're going to consider the potential links and actual links in the past between the Republican Party, elements of the petroleum industry, the intelligence community, and the, quote, terrorists, unquote, and the Islamic extremists, unquote, in Iran and Iraq. The following is from the Financial Times of London of Wednesday, October 18th of the year 2000. This is an article by Ruth Sullivan. It's headlined, Oil Prices Move Back Up as Iran Steps In. Just as oil markets were beginning to ease after President Clinton's midday announcement that Palestinian and Israeli leaders had agreed to try to end the outbreak of violence, Iran's defense minister called for oil to be used as a weapon and sent the price back to almost $31 a barrel. Shortly after news of a breakthrough in hostilities, crude prices slipped below $31 a barrel in mid-morning trading. New front month December Brent closed at $31.13 a barrel, having opened at $31.45. On his return from the summit in Egypt to Palestinian-controlled Gaza, Yasser Arafat, the Palestinian leader, pointed out that, quote, the implementation, unquote, of the agreement will be, quote, the most important thing, unquote. And it talks about the fact that Iran is viewed as one of the countries that may very well adversely affect the price of oil, with Iran's defense minister having called for oil to be used as a weapon, and that having sent the price back to almost $31 a barrel. And bear in mind who is now the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament. This research credit on the following goes to a listener. This from the San Francisco Examiner of Monday, June 12th of the year 2000. This is an article by Ali Akbar Darani, D-A-R-E-I-N-I, of the AP Dateline Tehran, headlined, Détente in Iranian Parliament. New Speaker elected unopposed. And this article reads in part as follows. A one-time hardliner and veteran revolutionary who now favors democratic reforms has been elected the Speaker of Iran's first reformist-dominated parliament in more than 20 years. Mehdi Karoubi was elected unopposed in a compromise between hardliners and moderates who said they wanted to avoid further tension at a time when the two factions are locked in a power struggle. Well, note Mehdi Karoubi, the, quote, moderate, unquote, Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, because Mehdi Karoubi has an interesting history of dealing with the Reagan and Bush administration elements with regard to, allegedly, the October surprise, the collusion with regard to the holding of the hostages taken from the U.S. Embassy, and also his name crops up in the context of the Iranian arms transfers that became better known later as part of the Iran-Contra scandal. Research credit on the following also goes to a member of the listening audience. This comes from the book Trick or Treason, the October Surprise Mystery. It's authored by Robert Perry, published in the United States by Sheridan Square Press, and copyright 1993, and of Mehdi Karoubi and his alleged involvement in the negotiations with the Reagan-Bush campaign to keep the hostages held until after Jimmy Carter's humiliation and resulting election defeat were assured, we read, after the July meeting with Casey, that's former CIA director and Reagan campaign manager William Casey, after the July meeting with Casey, Jamshid said, that's Jamshid Hashemi, let me begin one more time. After the July meeting with Casey, Jamshid said, Karoubi returned to Tehran where he consulted with Khomeini and the Ayatollah's senior advisors. 2 to 3 weeks later, Karoubi called and asked Jamshid for a second meeting. New arrangements were made, and that meeting, too, was held in Madrid at the Ritz. Casey and Donald Gregg again represented the American side, and Karoubi was back for the Iranians. Jamshid said that throughout the two rounds, quote, Casey was running things, unquote, but Gregg, quote, was giving information that Casey didn't know or even we didn't know about, really inside government information like where the spare parts were, unquote. At the second round, Karoubi again came dressed in full battle gear as an Iranian mullah. He confirmed Khomeini's agreement to release the hostages only after Reagan won power, Jamshid said, again quoting, Karoubi expressed acceptance of the proposal by Mr. Casey, unquote, Jamshid told us. The hostages would be released after Carter's defeat. And still later of dealings between the Reagan-Bush campaign and the Khomeini forces, and specifically the role of Mehdi Karoubi, now the Speaker of the Iranian Parliament, in those negotiations, when I asked if high-ranking cleric Mehdi Karoubi had played any role in these negotiations, Durrani, that's arms dealer Arif Durrani, who we looked at in RFA program number 32, continuing, Durrani said Karoubi had been a principal emissary. Again, quoting, whenever there is any contact overseas with foreign governments, he is like a nominated official by the inner group of the Iranians that they sent in to negotiate. Karoubi knows Nakhchivan really well, and Nakashon is actually the person who brought Karubi into these negotiations, unquote. Without further prompting, Durrani then volunteered another surprising assertion. Karubi also had meetings in Spain, unquote, the arms dealer said. And still later, Mehdi Karubi's name crops up in connection with the arms transfers that became better known as part of the Iran-Contra scandal. Specifically, one of the alleged major participants in those arms transfers was Hassan Karubi, the brother of Mehdi Karubi. Speaking of this, Robert Perry writes, another participant in those early Iran-Contra schemes was Iranian emissary Hassan Karubi, the brother of radical cleric Mehdi Karubi. So, to sum up, with the documented connections between the Reagan-Bush campaign and later between the Reagan and Bush administrations and extremist forces in Iran, with some of the Iranians involved in that détente, now in power in Iran, specifically Mehdi Karubi and the elements grouped around him, and with Dick Cheney, now the number two man, along with George W. Bush, George the Jr., I don't think it's unreasonable to ask to what extent the Iranians might deliberately structure events in this country, political events, in order to benefit not only themselves, but also the Republicans. Certainly that has happened in the past. Bear in mind, too, connections between the Reagan and Bush administrations and the Iraqis as well. Iraq, another, quote, Islamic extremist, unquote, nation, and another, quote, terrorist-supporting nation, unquote, is again a major petroleum producer and is also in a position to have a drastic effect not only on the price of oil but also on the world economy and, as a result, the U.S. election. We're going to read now from the Financial Times of Friday, November 3rd of the year 2000. This is an article by Carola Hoyos, a United Nations correspondent. It's headlined, U.S. Oil Groups Find a Discreet Way of Doing Business with Iraq. And this talks about some of the firms doing business with Iraq. One of those firms, surprise, surprise, is Halliburton Oil, whose CEO is Dick Cheney. Skipping down, we read, Halliburton, the largest U.S. oil services company, is among a significant number of U.S. companies that have sold oil industry equipment to Iraq since the U.N. relaxed sanctions 2 years ago. From 1995 until August of this year, Halliburton's chief executive officer was Dick Cheney, U.S. Secretary of Defense during the Gulf War and now Republican vice presidential running mate of George W. Bush. From September of 1998 until it sold its stake last February, Halliburton owned 51% of Dresser Rand. It also owned 49% of Ingersoll Dresser Pump until its sale in December of 1999. During the time of the joint ventures, Dresser Rand and Ingersoll Dresser Pump submitted more than $23.8 million worth of contracts for the sale of oil industry parts and equipment to Iraq. Their combined total amounted to more than any other U.S. company. The vast majority was approved by the Sanctions Committee. This, again, would obviously both Iraq and Iran, two countries with which the Reagan-Bush forces have traditionally dealt with, those two countries are in a position to have a drastic effect, a direct effect on the world economy and the U.S. elections. Bear in mind that, as we've looked at in the past, George W.'s advisors, both domestic and foreign, are basically drawn from his father's and Reagan's administrations. Bear in mind, too, that as of October of the year 2000, once again, a Middle Eastern terrorist incident is destabilizing the political situation there and the economic situation around the world. The San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, October 13th of the year 2000, has the following article, a Washington Post story by David A. Weiss, V-I-S-E, and Vernon Loeb, L-O-E-B. It's headlined, U.S. says Yemen attackers used inside information. And skipping down of the attack on the coal, we read, speaking of terrorist groups in the Middle East, a number of those groups have links to Saudi terrorist Osama bin Laden, who emerged yesterday as a prime suspect in the blast. U.S. officials repeatedly emphasized, however, that it is too early to say who perpetrated the deadly explosion aboard the coal. Well, one of the things that I wonder is to what extent some of the Islamic, as I've said, some of the Islamic fundamentalists, quote-unquote, and, quote, Middle Eastern terrorists, unquote, elements in the past that we've seen colluding with some of the Reagan and Bush administration elements and some of the related petroleum and intelligence elements, of the name Osama bin Laden is not unconnected with the Reagan-Bush administrations and the forces grouped around them. What we're going to do now is to listen to a short section of For the Record program number 186. This is from the broadcast entitled, What Does the W in George W. Bush Stand For? I'm going to take a look at a suppressed biography of George Bush. This is entitled Fortunate Son, subtitled George W. Bush and the Making of an American President.
This was authored by J.H. Hatfield, published in hardcover by St. Martin's Press, copyright 1999. Actually, it was copyright 2000 by Omega Publishing, although it came out in 1999. And this book was suppressed and recalled after it came out that J.H. Hatfield had a criminal record. Of the connection between the Bin Laden family and George W. Bush through his Arbusto Energy Company, we read as follows in Fortunate Son. Speaking of Bush, J.H. Hatfield writes, in June 1977, he formed his own drilling company, Arbusto Energy. Arbusto means Bush in Spanish. Like his father, who made his fortune in the oil business with the money of others, George W. founded Arbusto with the financial backing of investors including James R. Bath, a Houston businessman whom Bush apparently first met when they were in the same Texas Air National Guard unit. Tax documents and personal financial records show that Bath, an aircraft broker with business ties to Saudi Arabian sheiks, had invested $50,000 in Arbusto, granting him a 5% interest in two limited partnerships controlled by Bush. In one of the most bizarre footnotes to history, Time magazine described Bath in 1991 as, quote, a deal broker whose alleged associations run from the CIA to a major shareholder and director of the Bank of Credit and Commerce, unquote. BCCI, as it was more commonly known, was closed down in July of 1991 amid charges of multi-billion dollar fraud and worldwide news reports that the institution had been involved in covert intelligence work, drug money laundering, arms brokering, bribery of government officials, and aid to terrorists. An accounting commission by the Bank of England finally exposed the extent of BCCI's deficits and criminal offenses, forcing the bank's eventual collapse. Bath was never directly implicated in the BCCI scandal, but according to the Outlaw Bank, an award-winning 1993 book by Time correspondents Jonathan Beatty and S.C. Gwynn, Bath originally, quote, made his fortune by investing money for Sheikh Khalid bin Mahfouz and another BCCI-connected Saudi, Sheikh bin Laden, unquote. Allegedly the father of none other than Osama bin Laden, the man accused by the U.S. government of masterminding the August 1998 terrorist bombings of the American embassy in Kenya and Tanzania, which killed more than 250 people. According to news reports, in a 1976 trust agreement drawn shortly after Bush's father was appointed director of the Central Intelligence Agency, Saudi Sheikh Salim bin Laden appointed Bath as his business representative in Texas. Bin Laden, along with his brothers, owned Bin Laden Brothers Construction, one of the largest construction companies in the Middle East. In a 1991 deposition, Bath testified he was the sole director of Skyway Aircraft Leasing Limited, a Houston company owned by Khaled bin Mahfouz. Bin Mahfouz had been a major shareholder in BCCI, which had been accused of using Mideast oil money to seek ties to political leaders in other countries throughout the 1970s and 1980s. By the way, I would note that Oliver North used BCCI for many of his Iran-Contra machinations. Time reporters Beatty and Gwynn suggest in their book the $50,000 Bath invested in George W.'s Arbusto Energy Drilling Company may have belonged to Bath's Saudi clients, since the Houston businessman, quote, had no substantial money of his own at the time, unquote. Ironically, the money used to underwrite the first business venture of a possible future president of the United States may have been derived, at least in part, from the family fortune of Saudi terrorist Osama bin Laden. According to court documents, Bath also swore that in 1977 he represented four prominent and wealthy Saudi Arabians as a trustee and used his name on their investments in the United States. In return, he received a 5% interest in their deals. Federal authorities, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, and the FBI later investigated Bath after allegations were made by one of his American business partners that the Saudis were using Bath and their enormous financial sources to influence U.S. policy. And skipping down. In 1990, in an attempt to distance himself and his presidential father from the growing BCCI scandal, George W. stated in an interview that neither he nor the elder Bush had ever conducted business with James Bath. Junior went on record at the time as saying that he met the Houston businessman in 1970 when both were fighter pilots at the Air National Guard base at Ellington. President Bush, quote, knows Bath the way he knows thousands of people, unquote, his son told the press, and the two men could not be considered good friends. Quote, I've never done business with him, Bath, and I don't know, and I know the president hasn't either, unquote. Well, at least in the case of George W., he was lying. He obviously had been doing business with him. He was a Bath owned 5% in two limited partnerships controlled by Bush.
That again from For the Record program number 186. And as we wind down to the close of Campaign 2000, I wonder to what extent some of the events vis-a-vis the coal may also have been intended to destabilize the situation in the Middle East and give the election to the Republicans. Not a statement I'm making, but a question I'm asking in light of the Bush, Bin Laden family connections. That concludes For the Record program 256. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.